Salvata Mundi by Talis Contrapuntis and Contrapuntis and Owen Rees, our last offering for you today. It's Wagner tomorrow as we return to the Ring Cycle. And now the time at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3, time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. So over and I to Penny Gore.
Well, we are indeed surrounded by Wagner's music this week here at the Royal Albert Hall, but we've a break from it in this prom, though we do have a symphony by a man Wagner revered. The apotheosis of the dance was his now famous description of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. Well, tonight at the Royal Albert Hall, the BBC Philharmonic and chief conductor Juanjo Mena have a whole programme of music to get feet tapping and bodies moving. Not only that irresistible symphony by Beethoven, but also two exuberant Spanish-themed pieces. For Manuel de Falla's ballet The Three-Cornered Hat, the mezzo and Radio 3 new generation artist Clara Muriz will join the orchestra. And to close the prom, they'll play Ravel's Bolero. And there are special guests too. For both those Spanish pieces, the orchestra will be joined by the dancers of the Antonio Márquez Dance Company. To begin, though, we'll hear the latest of this year's 17 BBC commissions and co-commissions. And it's receiving its world premiere. Joy Box by the Liverpool-born pianist and composer John McCabe. His starting point was a memory of a trip to Japan a few years ago. "I was in Osaka," he says, "listening with amazement to an entertainment centre full of slot machines, playing widely different musical jingles, all going on simultaneously but independently. Eventually, I seemed to perceive a kind of musical structural pattern to the babel of noise, and this gave me the idea for what I hope is an entertainment piece." And coming on stage now to that applause is the guest leader of the BBC Philharmonic, Zoe Bayers. And following her on stage as the orchestra rises to its feet, Juanjo Mena, to open the BBC Philharmonic's evening with a prom's world premiere, Joy Box by John McCabe. sparked off by the sound of Japanese pachinko parlors with their amazing volume of madly competing jingles and the metallic crash of game machines. Joybox, a musical entertainment by John McCabe. A BBC commission receiving its world premiere here at the BBC Proms, performed by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by Juanjo Mena. And John McCabe here in the audience, and Juanjo Mena racing off the stage and up the aisle here at the Royal Albert Hall to embrace him and encourage him to take a bow. John McCabe writes in tonight's programme book that Joybox is dedicated to the memory of the composer Steve Martland, who died in May and whose own music was heard at the Proms as recently as last year. And Juanjo Mena making his way back on stage now, once again acknowledging John McCabe, whose own music has often been heard here at the BBC Proms. And our conductor makes his way off stage as we make ready for our second work, Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, first performed at a charity concert on December the 18th, 1813, in aid of Austrian and Bavarian soldiers disabled at the Battle of Hanau. The programme included another piece by Beethoven, Wellington's Victory, or the Battle of Vittoria, arranged for the fabulous Panharmonikon, a sort of mechanical orchestra designed by Beethoven's friend Johann Melzel. The players at the event included a host of famous musicians, Spohr, Meyerbeer, Hummel and Salieri among them. Panharmonikon was the last piece in the concert, but the symphony came first, and it was a huge success. Now, at the outset, it might not seem as though this piece is going to be upbeat in the slightest. There's an imposing, stately introduction, possibly lulling audiences into a false sense of security. But it doesn't stay that way for very long. After a bit of teasing, Beethoven suddenly springs a gear change that must have had the first night audience sitting up in some surprise. The second movement, Allegretto, a hypnotic march in the form of a set of variations, gives way to a busily scurrying scherzo, complete with a trio based, patriotically enough, on an old Austrian pilgrim hymn. But the finale really lets rip, bursting into a wild dance garlanded with horn calls and racing along to the finishing line in sheer, breathless jubilation. I've quoted Wagner already, the apotheosis of the dance, but as he also added, all tumult, all yearning and storming of a heart become here the blissful insolence of joy. And it's a fantastic piece to continue our evening of dance-related music here at the BBC Proms, though there are some very poignant contemporary accounts of Beethoven's conducting at the rehearsals and the first performance. His hearing loss was very acute by 1813, so he had to resort to physical expression to make his feelings known. Well, here's Juanjo Mena coming on to conduct tonight's performance of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
Now gently, now with daring, now serious, now wanton, now pensive and again exulting. Well, it seems only appropriate to quote Richard Wagner, whose music is all around us at the proms at the moment. And he was unstinting in his praise of Beethoven and this Seventh Symphony, performed by the BBC Philharmonic under its chief conductor, Juan Colmena. And even Beethoven himself had to admit the Grand Symphony in A is one of my very best. And Juan Colmena back, I'm sure, singling out some sections of the orchestra. Oboist Jennifer Galloway, flautist Richard Davis, and, well, the whole of the woodwind section, and of course the brass. One by one they stand, the horns now, and the trumpets, and timpani. Paul Turner the timpani, followed by all the strings. The whole orchestra on its feet now. And the original audience had a similar reaction, wild applause at the premiere. And one movement had to be premiered, perhaps surprisingly, not that amazing finale, but the second movement, Allegretto. Much to Beethoven's own satisfaction. Well, Juan Colmena making his way off stage, and that brings us to the interval in our prom. And after it, the dancing will continue quite literally when the BBC Philharmonic will be joined by the Antonio Márquez Dance Company for two works with a Spanish flavour, Manuel de Falla's ballet The Three-Cornered Hat and Ravel's Bolero. Well, during the next 20 minutes, the writer and broadcaster Stephen Johnson considers whether this famous piece may be an early sign of the brain disease that led to Ravel's death in 1937. To begin, we hear from Paul Patrick, we'll be playing the side drum in tonight's performance.
Basically, Bolero is a slow, repeated pattern which starts right at the beginning of the piece and goes right to the end, all but the last bar, exactly the same two-bar sequence. It's a great use of the snare drum, because one of the things the snare drum can do very well is repeat patterns. It has been compared to climbing Mount Everest. It certainly is a tour de force for the snare drummer. Most times I try to keep the tempo absolutely steady with the conductor all the way through and not vary.
Ravel's Bolero, an Everest for the snare drummer. So says Paul Patrick, principal percussionist of the BBC Philharmonic. What about for the listener, though, or for Ravel himself? Maurice Ravel is known as one of the most sophisticated, magically inventive of all French composers. Stravinsky compared him to a Swiss watchmaker. But Bolero is a remarkably, almost blatantly simple piece of construction. It's all based on repetition of a two-bar rhythmic pattern, plus a melody that also repeats. Only the orchestral colouring changes. For some people, it's just too simple, and Ravel himself called it a piece for orchestra entirely without music. Some have even suggested that Bolero's glaring simplicity is an early sign of mental degeneration. It's quite true that in his last years Ravel did suffer some sort of degenerative brain condition. So, is Bolero a bold experiment in radical simplicity, or does it mark the beginning of the end, an end that saw terrible decline in Ravel's mental functions, and finally a brain operation that seems to have gone horribly wrong?
Everybody felt, with one or two exceptions, that this extraordinarily intelligent and musical man was living a living death, really, and that it was unkind. I mean, if he was a dog, you would have put him down long before, I suppose one would say nowadays.
Ravel's most distinguished biographer, Roger Nichols.
It's very hard to read, first of all, because I'm not a medical man, but even those who are and have put some time and trouble into this don't find it easy to agree on what it was that happened. Whether he should have had the operation or not, there was a lot of discussion at the time, because he couldn't work.
And the outcome of the operation?
He regained consciousness briefly and recognised his brother, and then went unconscious again, and shortly after that he died.
What do you think, Roger, then, of the assertion that Bolero is a symptom of Ravel's mental decline in his last years?
I'm not convinced. Really, I'm not. We know he did die of a brain disease, but I think I should perhaps quote from, of all things, the Christian Science Monitor from, I have it in front of me here, the 17th of May 1924, that's to say 4 years earlier, saying that after he'd finished his opera, L'Enfant des Sortilèges, he said, "I shall perhaps start composing a symphonic poem without a subject, where the whole interest will be in the rhythm." Well, that doesn't exactly explain Bolero, because, of course, there is a tune. But it seems to me quite clear that he is thinking of going beyond the norms of orchestral writing already 4 years before he actually started work. Monotony was something that he embraced quite early on in his career. If you look at that early song, Sad, which is in just repeated chords. I mean, admittedly, it has a sort of religious, liturgical background, you may say, but then there's the Oiseau Triste, there's Le Gibet, there's repeated B-flats going right the way through the piece, and then there is the fact that he had to write something in a hurry. He got to know Ida Rubinstein, the Russian dancer, as a friend, and having enormous amounts of money at her disposal, she was going to put on a season at the Paris Opera in the November of 1928. So she suggested that he orchestrated some pieces out of the Albéniz piano suite Iberia. Ravel was on tour in America through the first 3 months of 1928, a highly successful tour. So he didn't get the letter with the commission until he got back from America in April of 1928. So he thought to himself, as she had thought, well, I'm not going to write a new piece, but I can do some orchestration. But of course, composition is quite a different matter. And then, sometime in late June, when he was just getting nicely stuck in, a Spanish friend said to him, "What are you working on these days?" And he told him, and he said, "Oh, really? Oh, but the copyright belongs to Enrique Arbos. He's just done some orchestrations of that." And Ravel said, "What? Damn it, who is this Arbos?" Arbos very sweetly agreed to give up his copyright in Ravel's favour if Ravel would like to take the work on. But he had a certain pride, and he wasn't going to be treated like this. He wasn't going to be taken advantage of. "No," he said, "if it's yours, it's yours, and I will have to find something else." And desperate letters then we have from him all through the summer saying, "What am I going to do? I can't let Ida down." And the next we know is that he is tapping out what turned out to be the Bolero tune, or at least a version of it. And he said, "Don't you think this has something rather insistent about it? Something that rather captures the imagination?" And it went on from there. It was just a question of what he felt he could do in the time without letting down a friend. Friendship for him was one of the most important things in life.
And how would what followed compositionally fit in with this idea of decline?
It wouldn't. Simply that, full stop. I mean, the two concertos and the three Don Quixote songs, you don't see any sign of iteration here. He's writing quite different kind of music. I should just finish by saying, perhaps, that when I wrote my first book on Ravel in the 1970s, I asked my local doctor, who was very interested in music, whether he would like to offer a diagnosis and whether he would like to put his name on it. And he said, "Under no circumstances, the whole of the neurological community will land on my shoulders with extraordinary force. Don't on any account do any such thing. Goodbye."
Well, fortunately, we have found a doctor who's prepared to speculate a little about Ravel's condition and its possible effect on his music. I've come to Queen's Square in London, surrounded by the buildings of University College, and here at the Dementia Research Centre, I'm going to meet the neurologist, Dr. Jason Warren.
So Ravel's fueled much speculation, but the documentary evidence has unfortunately now to be reconstructed. We do have quite a detailed account from his neurologist and to some extent the neurosurgical notes dating from his operation.
Do you think we'll ever reach a definitive diagnosis of Ravel's condition?
Well, his family declined permission for post-mortem, which unfortunately is often the last recourse of neurologists and neuropathologists. I think, unfortunately, it's doomed to remain the matter of speculation.
So what can you tell us about Ravel's brain condition, and what sort of effect might it have had on his ability to write music?
So Ravel, by both the medical notes and the account of his own correspondence, he gives a very eloquent, very touching account of what was happening to him, had clearly a progressive illness, and it was a focal illness, as neurologists say, in the sense that it had a focus in the brain, and we infer that from the symptoms that he had. So he didn't have a generalised loss of intellectual function, but he had very specific problems involving the use of words, the use of speech, and to some extent with the control of voluntary action. And unfortunately, this extended also to the actions involved in composing and performing music. And we make inferences based on this description that he had a form of what we would now call progressive aphasia or progressive apraxia, which are part of a spectrum of conditions where there is a selective degeneration of the brain, in this case the dominant hemisphere, the language hemisphere of the brain, which we now recognise can be due to probably a dozen or more different degenerative diseases. And neurologists have had a field day speculating, but one of the more popular putative diagnoses is a disease called corticobasal degeneration, which is really a description both of the degenerative process but also of the parts of the brain that are affected, the cortex and the basal ganglia. They act together as a unit, but the cortex is what we would regard as primarily responsible for higher functions, which include language and complex actions, and the basal ganglia act as a readout mechanism, really, for performing these actions efficiently and automatically.
Translating thoughts into actions.
Almost, yes.
So, what do you think, then, of the suggestion that Bolero, which comes very late on in Ravel's career, is a sign in its almost radical simplicity and its very repetitiveness of Ravel's degenerative brain condition?
So I understand where the suggestion has come from, and it's an almost irresistible one for neurologists. And the reason is because patients with particularly frontal lobe damage often become very repetitive, ritualistic, and obsessive. And it would be then not too much of a leap, you might think, to look at this music and say, well, you know, this has many of those characteristics. Was this the harbinger of the brain disease? I'm not a proponent of the theory, and I think that the counter-arguments are of two kinds. One is really from an inspection of the chronology of his output and looking at considerations like the music he produced after Bolero, for example, and the piano concertos are good examples. No one ever suggests that they're the products of brain disease. And the other line of evidence is Ravel's own writing about why he composed Bolero, and there is a quote from his own account. He says he's particularly desirous that there should be no misunderstanding about this work. It constitutes an experiment in a very special, limited direction, should not be suspected of aiming or achieving anything other or more than what it actually does. He says, before its first performance, I issued a warning to the effect that what I had written was a piece lasting 17 minutes and consisting wholly of orchestral tissue without music, of one very long, gradual crescendo.
With the kind of brain degeneration we're talking about, would a weakening of his sense of overall form be a possible symptom?
One would predict that a brain disease of this kind wouldn't leave musical output entirely unscathed. And I think the most basic point to make about Ravel's illness, and there's no question about this, is that it really is a tragedy of lost creativity. And we probably lost 15 years of music, probably, at least, as a result of this. So there's no question that it impacted on his output. But looking for the evidence that the work that he published or allowed to be published was in fact affected by brain disease, I think is a much more difficult proposition. And I would take Ravel's own statement about Bolero at face value.
Is it likely that we could have seen the beginnings of a degenerative process manifesting itself in 1928 when he wrote Bolero, and then suddenly he goes back, he sort of returns to his former heights of creativity? Is that possible?
Well, they tend, unfortunately, these diseases to be relentless and insidious rather than fluctuating. But from a neurological perspective, one way of approaching this might be to look at what was affected in Ravel's illness. And Ravel's illness seems particularly to have affected the execution of ideas. Now, there are other neurological illnesses which unfortunately strike at the storehouse of ideas and might well, one might predict, affect musical sensibility as an early feature. But I think there was actually evidence that Ravel's sensibility was maintained, and part of the frustration that he experienced was having ideas that he then could no longer execute because the apparatus to do that was destroyed.
Not every specialist agrees with Jason Warren's assessment, though. This is Dr. Eva Cybulska, writer and former consultant psychiatrist.
It would be both arrogant and, in fact, anti-scientific to attempt a precise diagnosis. However, I'm reasonably confident that on the balance of probabilities, he had dementia.
And do you feel that we see signs of this dementia in its early stages, maybe in a work like Bolero?
He actually had first symptoms at least a year before he composed Bolero. And the first symptoms he had, non-specific for dementia, I have to say, he had in 1926, which was lassitude. He called it cerebral anemia. That's how he called it himself. And insomnia, which became very much more severe later. And then in the year he composed Bolero, he got lost conducting his own music. And that is ominous.
And you've suggested an interesting term here, which is a very specialist term, perseveration. Perhaps you could explain what perseveration is.
Perseveration is a repetition, basically, in response to either non-existent stimulus or stimulus that ceased to exist. One could also look at it from another angle, that it is a form of disinhibition. We all grow in human civilization and learn to be inhibited. And the whole civilization is based on inhibition. We inhibit responses socially, personally, affectionately, and so on. There is a part in the brain which is responsible for this inhibition, which is called orbitofrontal cortex. And that seems to be damaged in, say, for instance, obsessive-compulsive disorder. And various connections leading in and out of this particular part of the brain. So, in other words, the brain doesn't say to itself, I have already done it, stop it, enough. It goes on and on and on.
Might it have been something innate or hereditary even?
There was some saying that his father may have suffered from some form of, let's say, organic brain syndrome, but the data we have is so scarce, really, that it would be yet another speculation.
And things like insomnia might have been a result of something like depression, for instance.
Indeed.
Yes.
Indeed, and that is probably the earliest beginning of it. Not long after his mother's death in 1917, he had insomnia and it progressed. So, as I said, it is a non-specific symptom, if you like. However, getting lost, conducting one's own composition, that is not due to depression, or I don't think it can be.
Are we talking about an inevitable gradual decline, or is it something that could fluctuate? Could he sort of go down and then up?
Indeed, it fluctuated. So it went in a kind of stepwise progression, and after each deterioration, there was some recovery, but partial. On each occasion, it was less and less recovery. So, for instance, after composing Bolero and after getting lost in the score, he completed apparently a very successful tour of North America. And also he composed the famous concerto for the left hand for Paul Wittgenstein and also concerto in G. So he obviously recovered to a point.
Then not long after that, he almost just stops composing.
Indeed, for the last 5 years of his life, he composed nothing. And this was his greatest tragedy. He developed what's called, in a clumsy way, amusia. He said himself in 1937 even, I have so much music in my mind and I can't say it.
So it was the actual process of getting it down that was
yes,
the problem.
Yes, and for a musician, the only other affliction could be deafness, which is equally devastating. And so he had this amusia.
Would you say, looking at it, though, that Bolero was a bad piece of music, a limited piece of music that reflects not just a decline on Ravel's part mentally, but a decline aesthetically, would you say?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think it's a beautiful and haunting piece of music with a Spanish melody and rhythm, which he was enchanted with these rhythms from the childhood. He was of Basque. His mother was Basque and he was born in Basque country. So maybe for him it was like returning to the womb, if you like, of his childhood, returning to the past. And it may have brought him some solace even.
Especially after the loss of his mother.
Exactly.
So it's almost as though there's some kind of regression going on?
Absolutely, that's exactly the word. That in the time of stress or trauma, and the stress, I think, was also, he was aware that his mind was deteriorating bit by bit. He had a great insight until the very end.
We could talk a great deal about the structural side of Bolero. But what about the emotional content, which is surely part of its appeal? What do you feel is going on here?
When he was a child, they used to go for regular holidays back to Basque Country. And he was fascinated by Spanish dance and by the rhythm and the songs and the performances. And one could perhaps say that in regressing almost to those happy times, maybe he was searching for a solace, for good times, for lost paradise, so to speak.
And children love repetition, don't
Indeed,
they?
Absolutely. So maybe in his fantasy, when his brain started gradually to disintegrate, that's what he needed.
Being devil's advocate here, it's still possible from what you've said that this regression could be explained as a reaction to external events, not necessarily a sign of degeneration in his mental powers.
Yes, absolutely true. That could be. But in the context of the entire picture of his other symptoms appearing in not too distant future, as it were, within the next year. So 10 years, actually, he had various signs and symptoms. For instance, not long after Bolero, he forgot how to swim. Another ominous sign. Then his writing deteriorated and was uneven. He was lacking in words. Normally, he was an eloquent man. And they were patchy and intermittent.
So the thoughts were there, the intention was there.
But the expression was impeded.
It into physical action was, impeded, yes. Are the signs that you find in a work like Bolero, this repetition, extreme pared-down simplicity, if you encountered them in another work, for instance, the long repetitive passage in the first movement of Shostakovich's Leningrad Symphony, would you say this is a sign that the composer is losing his faculties?
Or indeed, in the Brandenburg Concerto.
In the Brandenburg Concerto.
Number six. No, and as I say, everything has to be seen in the context. In another person, yes, it would have not had the same significance.
Well, this has blown the argument wide open, and just when it seemed we were reaching a consensus. But does any of this explain the music of Bolero? Most of all, does it explain the music's extraordinary mesmeric power, the quality that has made it one of the most popular, instantly recognisable classical pieces of all time? I can only leave that to you to decide. One thing is clear, though. Ravel did suffer terrible neural degeneration in his last years, the years of creative silence. And as Roger Nichols says, those last years must have been an appalling ordeal for this composer.
He was sitting out on the veranda of his little house, not doing anything, not even smoking. And one of his female friends said, "What are you doing, Moppies?" And he said, "I'm waiting."
Roger Nichols ending that programme, which was presented by Stephen Johnson, with contributions also from Dr. Jason Warren and Eva Sibulska. It was produced in Salford by Nick Holmes. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall with me, Penny Gore, live on BBC Radio 3 and online in HD sound. And Ravel's Bolero is one of the works we'll hear as we rejoin the BBC Philharmonic and its chief conductor, Juan Jimena, for the second half of a prom that revels in dance, with dancers on stage for the two remaining pieces, both of which are rooted in Juan Jimena's native Spain. Members of the Antonio Márquez company will be dancing, and Spanish mezzo Clara Muriz will be joining them to sing the passionate songs that Manuel de Falla added to his ballet score, The Three-Cornered Hat. Earlier, as we took a break outside the hall, I asked Clara about the folk music, the cante rondo, that Falla drew on in his score.
It feels very pure. It feels very ancestral, somehow, and very rooted in something even bigger than us, somehow. Falla himself was completely in love with the cante rondo, And I think that is because of that purity. And probably something that is quite interesting about it is the inspiration in the natural sounds that it has, the sounds of nature, the birds, the water, all the sounds of Andalusia.
Mezzo-soprano and Radio 3 New Generation artist Clara Muriz. Ofelia's ballet had its first performance produced by Diaghilev in London in 1919, with designs by Picasso, two star dancers from the Ballet Russe performing the lead roles, and Ernest Ansermet conducting the orchestra at the Alhambra Theatre. The story is a simple tale of country folk in southern Spain, the yearning of a pompous elderly dignitary, the corregidor or magistrate, for the miller's young and beautiful wife. And the hat of the title, in case you're wondering, is the magistrate's symbol of office. After much skirmishing, he is eventually taught a lesson by the couple, and the action set to a feast of Andalusian folk tunes. Well, the platform has been specially extended tonight to make room for the dancers, headed by the company's founder, Antonio Márquez, as the miller, and Elena Miño as the miller's wife. Just to set the scene a little more, we've got a few props on stage to aid the performance. We've got a well, complete with bucket, and a table with pitchers of wine and plates of fruit, particularly a bunch of grapes. Now, that's going to be significant later. Plays a pivotal role when the miller's wife teases the magistrate with them during one of their dances. And coming on stage now, Clara Muriz, to sing those songs in the folk style with Juan Jimena. The dancers will be on stage shortly for Falia's The Three-Cornered Hat.
Good evening, everyone. It is a pleasure for us to present the second half, which celebrates Spanish music and dance. However, the dancers, the flamenco company, the musicians, and I have in our thoughts those who have lost their lives in the Spanish train accident last night. This is Santiago de Compostela Day. Santiago de Compostela's Day. And that region is especially known to me. With this sympathy, we wish to remember all those whose lives have been affected by yesterday's tragedy. Thank you. Enjoy with us.
Manuel de Falla's The Three-Cornered Hat, the BBC Philharmonic conducted by Juan Colmena with the mezzo Clara Moriz and with the Antonio Marquez Company. Splendidly dressed in folk costume like a Goya painting come to life. Women in swirling skirts, men in jerkins and breeches. And, well, you could hear the castanets that they were all wielding with absolute expertise. Antonio Marquez himself was a very macho miller, complete with suave red trousers, and Elena Mino coquettish in flounces of red and green as his wife. And the corregidor sported a cape as well as his three-cornered hat, which he lost, along with his dignity, at the end of the ballet. A virtuoso performance, absolutely inexhaustible. And it doesn't end there, because in a few minutes they'll present their interpretation of the last work in the Prom, the subject of our 20 minutes, Ravel's Bolero. But they will stay on stage before that for a dance interlude for the whole company. Some of it, as you'll hear, electrifyingly energetic, but with some very quiet passages too, so if you wonder why there's a sudden hush, that explains it. And I'm sure you're wishing you could see this too. Well, from 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, you will be able to do that. Clips of this part of the evening will appear on the Prom's website, and the whole of the second half of the concert is on BBC Four on Friday, the 2nd of August. Well, as you can hear, there are some fans of the Antonio Marquez Company in here tonight. And quite a lot of them sitting near me as well, as you can hear from the great cheers and roars of approval. And that particularly big cheer is for the founder of the company, Antonio Marquez. Born in Seville, studied at Spain's National Ballet School, and he was a lead dancer there. And he's trying to persuade Juan Colmena to take a solo bow, but he's not keen. He wants to go round the orchestra and bring Clara Moriz from her place by the woodwind section. And here she is coming on stage, one of our Radio 3 new generation artists. And she now being escorted to the front of the stage by Antonio Marquez. Looking very beautiful in a long green dress, which with her auburn hair is particularly elegant. And she's escorted off stage by a very portly Antonio Marquez. And Juan Colmena now asking the brass section to stand. And the percussion, two more castanets in the percussion section, just to bolster what we were hearing on stage. A harp in the orchestra too, and now the strings rising to their feet and being applauded by the dancers. Antonio Marquez coming forwards. He's really insistent that Juan Colmena should share in this applause, but he's very modest. An embrace for these two Spaniards. And the energy that these dancers show is quite extraordinary. Take a look at those clips tomorrow on the Radio 3 website and the Prom's website, and you'll see exactly what I mean. Ravel's Bolero, a piece he once called a work for orchestra without music, but I don't think anyone here tonight would agree with that. Well, I think that's what everyone here wanted. Not an encore, perhaps, but more maybe a reprise for orchestra and dancers of Ravel's Bolero, played by the BBC Philharmonic under Juan Colmena and danced by Antonio Márquez and his company from Madrid. Founded in 1995, now in demand all over the world. They performed in Rio in front of an audience of 40,000 and taken their flamenco wedding all over Europe and America. And the dancers all linking arms. Antonio Márquez with two of his female dancers. I should say that there's been a costume change for this final part of the programme. The women in shades of red and pink, the men in black. The traditional flounce dresses for the women that are so familiar from flamenco. And Juan Colmena and the orchestra just applauding in wonder as the whole company takes a bow. And time for Juan Colmena to give the orchestra its due. And that huge cheer is for the flautist Richard Davis. All those members of the woodwind section. The brass. That's the trumpet, Jamie Prophet. The flutes, the piccolos. Jennifer Hutchinson doing sterling work as the piccolo player. And, well, the biggest cheer of all for Paul Patrick, who played the side drum that underpins the whole piece. Well, applause, well, for everybody, really. Everybody applauding each other. And Juan Colmena finally accepting the invitation to come to the front of the stage and take a bow with the dancers. Well, tomorrow we're back here at the Proms with the Ring Cycle continuing with Siegfried. The cast includes Nina Stemmer as Brunhilde and Lance Ryan as Siegfried, making his Proms debut. That begins at 5 o'clock tomorrow. But now with the insistent rhythm of Ravel and of those dancers still in our ears here, it's time to return you to Broadcasting House and to the studio where James Jolly is waiting.
Thanks, Penny. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. And don't forget that every prom is available for 7 days online via the Radio 3 website. And as Penny said, with Siegfried tomorrow, you may want to do your homework by listening to the two operas that precede it in Wagner's Ring Cycle, Rheingold and Die Walküre. Just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and you can listen to both works from earlier in the week, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Now, we've a moment or so before free thinking, so let's stay with the dance, but travel way back in time and mood for music by John Dowland. Two Galliards by John Dowland, the Earl of Essex, and Sir John Such, played by Fretwork, and they're coming to the proms on September the 2nd.
A BBC Proms concert exploring the twin keys of C major and C minor. Pianist Paul Lewis plays Mozart's elegant C major concerto No. 25. And Daniel Harding and the Mahler Chamber Orchestra make a welcome return to the BBC Proms. Join me, Andrew McGregor, Tuesday night at 7:30.
And now we've another programme from Radio 3's Free Thinking Festival of Ideas, which took place last year at the Sage Gateshead. Tonight, Rana Mitter is in conversation with the novelist Philippa Gregory.
From Donizetti to Shakespeare, Anne Boleyn has been one of those figures irresistible to the mind of the creative artist. Rarely in history can being beheaded have been such a great career move. But surely one of her most compelling manifestations comes from the pen of Philippa Gregory. Philippa's novel, The Other Boleyn Girl, tells the story of Anne Boleyn's rise and fall through the eyes of her sister Mary. It shot up the bestseller list on its publication a decade ago and then became a movie starring Scarlett Johansson. But the Boleyn drama is just one of the many tales woven by a queen of historical fiction whose throne is rather more secure than that of some of her heroines. Her Tudor court series of six books has been joined in recent years by the historical prequel, The Cousins' War, the story of the Plantagenets. And the latest in the series is The Kingmaker's Daughter, to be broadcast next year. Today, in conversation here at the Sage Gateshead, in association with New Writing North, we'll tackle history, fiction, and the way that they come together. Would you please welcome our guest, Philippa Gregory. Philippa, last year on Radio 3's Night Waves, we debated V.S. Naipaul's statement that women's writing was overly sentimental. And I have to say, defending that position was a male novelist, I won't name him here, who argued that he regarded Jane Austen as being less of a writer than, say, Dickens, because of her small and narrow focus. What do you make of that sort of comment?
Well, it's part of a long tradition of patronising women writers, which is part of a long tradition of patriarchy, which is patronising women. So since I am a survivor of this long tradition, I take the survivor's right to say I'm not even going to address it. But actually, Dickens is one of the most lusciously weepy, tragic... I mean, this is a man who cried at his own performances. You know, Jane Austen wouldn't have gone on stage crying at her own performances. Jane Austen was a writer of incredible restraint. You know, there is enormous emotion there, but it's perfectly managed by a very, very rigid structure, which is the nature of the novel. I think what I would agree with is that women are, I believe, much more emotionally aware, partly because of their upbringing, but also because I think the novel, ideally, is a vehicle for the analysis of emotions, and women are particularly good at analysing emotions, partly as a survival technique, but also because I think we are wired that way. I think we're interested in relationships in a way that some men manage not to be. What's interesting is, of course, they elevate that into some kind of, you know, standard of how you should feel. Stiff upper lip, you know, self-control, private misbehaviour, public, you know, whitewash, all of those sorts of things which we cherish so much in our society today, I think is part of the repression, the Anglo-Saxon repression of emotion.
I'll put some of those thoughts on a postcard and send them over to V.S. Naipaul. We'll see if he writes back. I'm intrigued by the way in which you referred, you know, almost to evolutionary biology, you know, the DNA of the way in which one comes up with the novel as a vehicle. And that reminds us that one of the things that comes from DNA is sex and gender, the social manifestation of it. And you talk about emotion as one of the frameworks which is used to write. When you are writing, does that mean that you feel you are writing for women?
Oh, no. No, I've got much too much to do to think about who's going to read it. First of all, I have to deal with this massive amount of factual material, dates, places, weather, illness patterns, who's doing what, where anybody else is. Particularly if you're writing about women, you're often writing about people who are not in the historical record. You have to go and find them, or you have to speculate about where they are or what they're doing. So I've got all of that research going on. Then I'm imagining myself there, then I'm caught up in that story and trying to also make sure that the dialogue is authentic, that I'm not describing anybody's touch as electric, which is no good in the historical novel. When I'm in character, I don't even know about circulation, so I can't even say my heart races. I can say my heart races, but I don't really understand what is happening in a biological sense. So I've got an awful lot to do. I haven't got any time to worry about who's reading it or whether they'll like it. I worry about that after publication. And then I worry intensely, yes.
And when you're making that set of decisions driven by the research, what about the thing that seems to me perhaps the most difficult line to tread for a novelist who's doing what you're doing, which is the line between making the voice sound modern enough to be accessible to the reader, but authentic, plausible enough to be the voice of someone who could have lived in the 16th century or even before, you know, the modern self and how it's a very different sort of self at that time.
I think that's really very interesting. I do believe that there is, you know, people say to me all the time, and often I'm too polite to argue, human nature never changes. I believe that human nature changes all the time. But I think there are some constant anxieties. You know, there are probably some kind of hierarchy of needs, you know, which we know about. So, you know, your desire to survive, your desire to see your children survive, your desire to prosper, if possible. And in the case of the Plantagenets, this burning desire to be King of England, which is, you know, part of their difficulty. Something like that, I think, is probably common to every human being, because part of being alive means that you have a desire to be alive.
Could you let us into the workshop? I mean, what is a case, perhaps in a recent novel you've written, where you had to make specifically that sort of decision?
I think that what mediates it is the fact that since Freud and since the modern world, we're really conscious of our importance, if only to ourselves. We have ideas of ourselves as an individual. We have ideas of ourselves as a personality. Whereas if you look at someone like Anne Neville, who is the heroine of The Kingmaker's Daughter, she is absolutely raised to think of herself as a representative of her house, as someone who can support her father's ambitions, and as someone who, when she is married into another house, is absolutely obliged to support their ambitions. In addition to that, all of this medieval period, they're profoundly spiritual people. So there's a whole load, if you will forgive me being vulgar about it, there's tons of God, which the modern reader doesn't really want to know about or understand, and which I refer to, but which I certainly don't deal with the seriousness and depth that a medieval writer would deal with it. So most people think most of the time that God is calling them to this action, whereas we would think most of the time that our personal interests were calling us to this action.
When I read The Other Boleyn Girl, a novel which many people here will know, which I very much enjoyed, one of the things that was most compelling about the character of Mary Boleyn, the sister of the more famous Anne, perhaps slightly more famous, was that she expressed, you know, a love and sentiment for her children, the desire not to be caught up in this sort of game of cards that was the courtly intrigues of the time. But I found myself wondering, would a Mary Boleyn really have thought and said those things?
What made Mary Boleyn for me as such a great heroine of a novel is I would have thought with you, probably not. This is a time before aristocratic women marry for love. It's a time before people even defend the idea of marriage for love. Love is one thing based on physical attraction. Marriage is part of forming a dynasty. It's business. It would be like saying, why don't Random House and Penguin merge, because they love each other. You go like, no, that's a ridiculous concept. So the idea that a medieval woman, aristocratic woman, would marry for love is a ridiculous concept to her, except that she, after she has been married as a dynastic marriage, after she's had an affair with the king, which was, I believe, initially entirely for the interests of her family, she runs away from court. She makes a secret marriage. She writes a fantastic letter to Cromwell, Thomas Cromwell, the secretary, and she says, well, might I have had a better man of birth and nobler, but I dare say not one that would have loved me, nor one that I would have loved more. I would rather be married to him than the greatest queen christened. And there you have an absolutely, in a sense, modern, totally surprising statement of a defence of marriage for love from a medieval woman. And when I read that, I was in the London Library. I actually went, oh, I've got a bestseller. I've got such a bestseller. And what I couldn't understand was that no one else, this is published in a book, I didn't find it, you know, in someone's attic. No one else had read that in the intervening 600 years and gone, this is the most extraordinary thing for a woman to write at that period. And that gave me the character of Mary, that she was someone who was guided by her emotions and a desire for happiness.
When you make the case for history and fiction being similar in some ways, isn't there a central point that differentiates them, that history is ultimately about argument and the narrative is about the journey, not necessarily the end point?
No, I'm sure history is about the end point. And one of the things I don't like about history is that, in a sense, they rush to the end point and the whole of the journey is overshadowed by the historian's knowledge, foresight of what is to come. One of the things that I love about writing fiction, especially in present tense, which is absolutely my signature style now, is that the people who are living the lives do not know what is going to happen to them. And in a sense, you as a reader are invited into the device that you know no more than they do. So none of us know that Anne Boleyn is not going to be pardoned, because if you had been there, you would have been certain she would have been pardoned. You would not have dreamed the King of England would behead his own wife on a scaffold. It's an extraordinary thing for him to do, and the enormity of it is totally obscured by the way that historians, not very good historians, write about Anne Boleyn as if from the moment they meet, she is certain to be condemned for adultery. So they, in a sense, read back from her death and the sentence and pick up all sorts of courtly love stuff, all sorts of flirtatious stuff, relationship with other men, in a sense saying to you, this is what is going to happen. So in a sense, I disagree with you completely. I think history is incredibly end result oriented, whereas what I love about fiction is that it's possible to say, simply, we're living this now. This day went really, really well. Who would dream that tomorrow that would happen?
But that view is presumably shaped by the fact that early on in your career, you actually did a PhD in history yourself, so you are actually a trained historian as well as a novelist. Did that experience turn you away from the idea of history?
I think what you learn when you study history in some detail is the extraordinary amount of bias that creeps into it, that in a sense is rendered invisible because of the reputation of the historians. And what's interesting to me is to read a character's life and say, actually, I'm not even going to take the traditional view of this character. I'm going to look, in a sense, sideways. I'm going to look at someone else altogether and take a view of them. So I'm going to do new research, and that immediately moves me away from the prejudices and the tradition of history.
Well, I'd like you to drill down a little further for us into that period, not with, in this case, with the Boleyns, but with Catherine of Aragon. And you've chosen some readings that show us a progression in the journey between the historical source and ways in which fiction has dealt with that story. I wonder if you'd introduce them for us.
Well, this is a bit of a study. This first passage is written by the Spanish ambassador. And I'll struggle with reading it because it's Old English as translated. And as soon as the princess's servants were ascertained of the coming of the king, they showed him that the princess was in her rest, whom he answered in such form that if she were in her bed, he would see her and converse with her, for that was the mind and the intent of his coming. And thus, convenient leisure to her respited, she gave him an honourable meeting in her third chamber. Henry VII has, in a sense, bought Catherine of Aragon for his son Arthur, and she's arrived in England, and he's made up his mind he's going to see her. And it's not the tradition for a Spanish bride, the Infanta, to be seen by anyone before her